is JS Party, your weekly celebration of JavaScript and the web. The software world moves fast. Keep up the easy way with Changelog News, the only software newsletter that's also a podcast. Sign up today at changelog.com/news. Big thanks to our partners at Fly. Launch your app as close to your users as possible. Fly makes it easy. Learn how at fly.io. Okay, it's party time, y'all.
What's up, friends and party people? I'm here with my good friend over at Speakeasy, founding engineer George Hadar. Speakeasy is the complete platform for great API developer experience. They help you produce SDKs, Terraform providers, docs, and more. George, take me on a journey through this process. Help me understand exactly what it takes to generate an SDK for an API at the quality level required for good user experience, good dev experience.
The reality is the larger your API becomes, the more you want to support users that want to use your API. And to do that, your instinct will be to ship a library, a package, and what we've been calling an SDK. There's a lot of effort involved in taking an API that lives in the world and creating a piece of software that can talk to that API. Building SDKs by hand is a significant investment, and a lot of large companies might pour a lot of money into that effort to create something that's like approaches good developer experience. And then another group of a more growing group of companies will rely on tooling like code generators. And so they're very interested in, like, once you make the decision to use a code generator, you're kind of forfeiting some of your own opinions and what you think a good developer experience is, because you're going to delegate that to a code generator to give you an SDK that you think users will enjoy using.
Okay, so paint a picture. What's a good next step? What can people expect when they go to speakeasyapi.dev?
If you're coming across Speakeasy today and you want to use it, you will go through the onboarding flow, and at some point, you're going to give us an open API document. That's your description of your API, and we're going to take that document and turn it into an SDK of your choice. You're going to get to pick which language is your first language. That's the one you'll get for free. And at that point, you can publish that package for the world to use. That's going to be yours. It's you get to license that however you want, and then carry on from there. The way you iterate now is you keep changing your open API document. So as you develop your backend, you're going to produce alongside that the open API document with any updates over time and evolve that. And as you're evolving that, we're generating the SDKs and publishing them for you. And that also includes rich documentation that goes with them. So we're asking you to put a lot of effort just into describing your API, and we're going to do a lot of the heavy lifting that follows from that.
Okay, so as George mentioned, go to speakeasyapi.dev. You get your first SDK for free. So cool. Once again, speakeasyapi.dev.
Hello, once again, JS Party Animals. I'm Jared, your internet friend, and I'm joined today by Brian LaRue. Welcome to the pod, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
Having you back, actually. I think you've been on a handful of times. Always interested in what you are up to, and you're up to something right now, you and your friends.
I'm always up to something sneaky.
Yeah. Enhance WASM, or WASM, depends on if you want to rhyme with awesome, is a new thing from you and your team at Enhance. Lay the groundwork for a conversation here. What's Enhance, and then what's Enhance WASM?
Yeah, so Enhance was kind of a response from our team to the state of modern JavaScript frameworks. We've got a lot of them, and they're great, and they patch a whole bunch of holes in the web platform that we don't have anymore. So be it Svelte or React or what have you, they all add a module system, and they all add a component system, and then they compile that away to generate HTML. And we realized that the browser has these things. The browser didn't used to have a module system, famously, for a really long time, but we We now have pretty ubiquitous ES modules. And the browser has a component system called Web Components, which
it does
has a storied.
maybe a surprise to some. Like it's there; it's been there a long time, but it seems like people are just realizing it's in there.
Well, and you know, it went through some classic software iteration. It took a while for it to kind of come up to speed, and it's got limitations, but it's good. You know, these things are built in now, and you can extend HTML natively. You can create your own elements, so you can open up DevTools, you can see those elements, inspect them, change them. And this is pretty nice compared to the div soup that we get from transpilers that generate code. You get more of an even match between what you write and what you run, which makes debugging better, but even better still, you're not sending a bunch of code to user land to do stuff the browser can already do. So you get better performance as a result. And one of the big holes with web components is that they're very client-side JavaScript centric. You implement a class by extending HTML element, and then you register that with the custom elements define call, which runs client-side. So this happens after client-side JavaScript kicks in. And we wanted to do a lot of stuff before client-side JavaScript kicks in. If you take like a normal web page, just like any given web page, most of the elements on that page are inert. They don't have event listeners.
They're just sitting there.
Yeah, they're just hanging out, you know, drawing boxes or whatever. And that's great, but it's funny because our whole programming model is downstream thinking about JavaScript or HTML elements as something JavaScript created, manages, and maintains. And that's kind of inefficient. So server rendering is becoming popular again, which is great because that performs better. And it's also closer to how the ultimate page works. You know, you just get a bunch of inert HTML. And then you can kind of save your client-side JavaScript for the stuff that client-side JavaScript can only do. So Enhance is a way to server render web components. And we're unique in this way. There's other projects that are sort of attempting to do this through build steps and stuff, but they're not quite there yet. And we took an approach that was a little bit different than other projects like Lit. Whereas Lit like wants to think about the whole world as like JavaScript executes and some events fire, and then I insert some HTML inside of myself. And we're inverting that and saying, define templates using JavaScript, using just plain JavaScript, and then we'll render those templates and expand all the elements for you with state on the server side. And if you want, on the client, you can then also run JavaScript. But for the vast majority of the elements that you're producing for a web page, you won't need to do that. So the classic kind of example I like to give is your header and your footer of your website. Mm-hmm. Those probably don't need JavaScript, but they definitely need to render. And they're going to have a whole bunch of elements, like links and stuff.
Sure.
And you want to pump those out into the page as quick as possible so people can have a good user experience at the end of the day. They can navigate around. If JavaScript fails, you still get some UI. And if you want, at that moment, you know, you can run client-side JavaScript and do whatever you want inside of that. So that's what Enhance does at a high level. It's server-side rendering of web components. And that's been fun, and we like that. And one of our devs came across a blog post from Shopify where they were working with a thing called WasmTime and QuickJS. And they had created a way to compile QuickJS into WASM with a JavaScript module and then be able to execute that in any WASM-compatible runtime. So most of the time when we think about WASM or WASM,
however you
I'm
like,
sure which it is, yeah. But yeah, I'm Canadian, so I sometimes say JavaScript. So maybe I should say WASM.
I would appreciate you to say JavaScript every time.
JavaScript.
I like that.
I like unlearned that going to conferences because people just look at me and be like, JavaScript.
Who is this guy?
Usually when we think of WASM, we think, let's take some native code and run that in the browser, which is a cool use case and brought a whole bunch of stuff to the browser. This technique that the Shopify guys figured out lets us take JavaScript browser stuff and run that in different backend runtimes. And so one of our devs was like, wow, I wonder if I could run the Enhance SSR module in WASM. And if we could we then server render JavaScript components from different backend runtimes like Java or PHP or Ruby, Python, Rust, whatever. And it worked. which we were all kind of surprised. Yeah.
It seems like I wouldn't say it a hack, but it seems kind of roundabout or something.
It feels hacky. Yeah, no, it does. Because we're bringing a whole JavaScript runtime to the party. And like, there's a whole bunch of immediate things you think. Like, one, if you're bringing a whole JavaScript runtime to WASM, that's got to be big, right? Like, that's got to be fast or slow.
Slow, big,
and it's not. It's fast. It's tiny. Yeah, it's pretty quick. You end up with like a 3 megabyte payload, but on the server side, that's not as big of a deal.
Right.
And this opens up a whole bunch of really cool use cases. So in the past, we've kind of maintained a good clean separation between our front ends and back ends, but that does create its own problems with those separations of concern. So if I build my whole front end in React, that's great. But now if I want to server render anything, I have to run Node.
Exactly.
Or Dino or Bun or something like that. And a lot of shops don't do that. Like, there's tons of shops out there that are running Java or Python or whatever. And so they end up with spinners. They end up with a fully client rendered app, skeleton screens, and poor user experience as a result. And that's a bummer. So this technique would allow them to do a design system, build a bunch of components, and still be able to server render them in any backend runtime that they want, which is pretty exciting.
I agree with you 100%, which is why I was immediately excited about this. And I immediately reached out and I was like, this seems like this could be, I don't want to overuse the term game changing. And of course it does feel like a hack, but the possibilities it opens up are really big for a lot of shops. And so I want to get the word out about it because it seems like it could be a really good thing for a lot of people.
Well, and I don't think it has to be just us. So there's a lot of zero-sum thinking these days in open source. But you know, now the road is paved. So there's nothing saying someone can't take this technique and use this for other types of renderers. So like maybe you want to use handlebars on the client server and get that working in both places. Or maybe you want to try and get React working. I don't think it will work very well from a performance perspective, but it's worth a shot. And yeah, there's the kind of big example for me has been design systems. So this is a pretty big trend these days. It kind of comes out of big co's. So if you've ever worked at a big company, you quickly learn that big companies don't grow kind of organically. They grow through acquisition. And what ends up happening is you get a big company that's actually 10 or 11 companies in a trench coat. And each one of those acquisitions has a different stack.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And so... So design systems came around. We're like, what we'll do is we will have a cohesive UI for our entire portfolio of products. And we'll basically be re-implementing that in each one of these stacks. And so if you've got your blogs in WordPress, you're going to be implementing the look and feel inside of PHP. But if the main app is running in Java Spring, you're going to be jumping into a thing called TimeLeaf. And if parts of the app are written in Node, you're going to be jumping over to Node. So this would let you have a design system with a single set of definitions, and you would lose that kind of uncanny valley of having to re-implement everything in every different backend, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, for me, it also opens up the possibility of just globally sharing of components, right? Like across every stack. It's like, well, here's a web component that this person wrote. It's really high quality. It does all the things. It has all the accessibility built in. Like everything's been thought through. And now... if you can basically run WASM on your backend, which is most languages at this point, then you can server-side render that sucker and just integrate it into your application, no matter what you're doing or where you are. And I think that's pretty cool. I think it opens up a lot.
What's up, friends and party people? I'm talking to you today about our friends over at Clerk, the complete suite of embeddable UIs, the full-on most comprehensive user management platform. If you're using React or Next.js, Clerk is perfect for you. Embeddable UIs, flexible APIs, and admin dashboards to authenticate and manage your users. And I'm here with Clerk CEO Colin Sidoti. Colin, give me the backstory. Why does Clerk exist?
When we started Clerk, we were definitely frustrated that a lot of the authentication solutions, both services or open source, kind of didn't have a good UI built in. And we would look at Google's sign-in experience and Google's user profile. And it just had this like degree of polish and professionalism to it. It just didn't come out of the box with everything else. Usually you start with just email, password as the sign-in options, and then you kind of have to add in extra modules to get OAuth on. And, you know, in the user profile, having a profile picture and setting up 2FA, right? It's like all this extra work that you have to do. And with Clark, I think we really were inspired by Stripe Checkout, where here's a checkout and it's great, right? Like, and we had this question of why didn't that exist for auth really? And so for Clark, you drop in our components and it's really just a complete like end-to-end experience right out of the box with that high degree of polish, high degree of professionalism that I think users have really come to expect these days.
Okay, so easy to drop in components. Really beautiful UI, by the way. I love it. Very nice. Clark must be the most welcomed easy button when it comes to authentication, good UI, and all that, right?
One of the most striking things, you know, still to this day, I think Clark might be the only auth solution that comes with a user profile screen. And it's so insane to think about because you need the user profile screen because that's where the user goes and they self-serve to set up 2FA. And it ties back into the sign-in. And so it's like, we had to do that to be able to offer that experience. But it's so bizarre to us. Auth depends so much on user profile, yet most auth solutions don't include it. And it's just this weird, bizarre thing that never made sense to us. And so approaching it from first principles, we have it out of the box.
Very cool. So pixel perfect UIs embedded in minutes, React or Next.js. This is the easy button for you. Clark is perfect for you. It is a full-on comprehensive user management platform with, as I said, beautiful UI. Best of all, they have pricing that scales with you. They have a phenomenal free tier, 10,000 monthly active users for free. Plus, when you scale to a paid plan, they have first day free. This means you won't be charged for users who sign up and never return. So that's phenomenal. Every feature you need now and as you scale. Get started at clerk.com. That's clerk.com. Once again, clerk.com.
Feels like a holy grail moment for sure. And I'm certain, you know, there's probably people listening that want to figure out how to get this kind of go in for themselves, or maybe they don't want to use web components, which is totally cool, by the way. I'm all about diversity in our solution space. So we used a project called Extism, and it's spelled kind of weird, but it's E-X-T-I-S-M. And it made this dead simple. So our renderer is already pretty dead simple. I think it's got two dependencies. One of them's parse5. We effectively take a string of HTML. We find all the custom elements inside of that, and then we expand them. And so our render is like a couple hundred lines of JavaScript with two dependencies. So packaging it was super easy. I think more complicated renderers, kind of the more mature frameworks that have been doing this stuff for a while, might have more difficulty bundling and packaging this stuff. But definitely check out Extism if you want to run a JavaScript module in a weird place like Python or Ruby or something like that. They absolutely made this possible.
I will link up to that. Their GitHub has a list of languages that they support. Or how do you say
it? It's pretty comprehensive.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't find one. Even Haskell, OCaml. I mean, some pretty obscure ones. Zig, which is, of course, up and coming, but not the thing that you're going to typically running like a web application, you know, back end on. But yeah, lots of things. Happily, I did see Elixir on the list, so we are Elixir backenders around here at Changelog. Our platform is written in Elixir. Of course, tons of JavaScript runs in our front end, but I would love to have shareable web components that I can just run from my Phoenix backend and just SSR those suckers into my application.
And there might be other things that you could do there too, like a common one is shared validation logic. So maybe you've got something that, I don't know, verifies a form or whatever.
Sure.
It'd be nice to be able to reuse that across different properties as the form mutates with time, which they tend to do.
That has been a panacea I've been chasing for many years. Back when I was writing my Ruby on Rails apps and my client-side JavaScript, and I tried to, you know, get those validation rules to matriculate into JS land, and it was never, it was just always a mess. We kind of get it working, and then something messes up, especially uniqueness validation specifically, which require a server-side call because you can't check that in client, of course. Unless you're going to ship your whole user database into the browser, but not advised.
Right. And you got to do that back-end call anyways because the client could be compromised.
Lying, yeah.
We had a lot of fun. I hadn't touched Rails since 2.3 was the last time I'd played with it. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of delightful to get this demo running because it was like seeing an old friend, you know,
when you right. pick up. I remember this.
There was no delay. It was like Rails new. Oh yeah, that still works.
Like riding a bike. Yeah. You know, you're like, it feels natural.
Everything's kind of, there's a few new folders. There's a few new idioms, right. but like generally felt productive. It's something that I really missed actually.
Yeah. I use it up to about 5 or 6 and it's probably been maybe 10 years now, maybe less than that I've used it like on the daily. And I've been like slowly people have been drawing me back in with reasons to like pick up and start a Rails new. Haven't done it yet, but I wouldn't mind trying it. It seems like it would be kind of fun. Nostalgic almost, you know?
It is a little nostalgic, but yeah, it's you know, held its own and still pretty good. And I had the classic Ruby experience where my whole install was borked and it took me a day to figure out why.
That's the biggest problem with it. I mean, I guess thankful for Docker, although I don't like to run Docker on my Mac because it's so stinking slow on the Mac, but you know, being able to have some sort of container-based setup for Rails specifically, because Ruby version management over the years has been just a cesspool and a hard problem to solve, apparently.
I mean, they all are, really.
Yeah.
And this project helped to remind us of that fact.
Because you guys went out and set up, like, are they example apps? Is that what you call them? Or implementations? Like, here's what it would look like to run your WASM server-side in Rails, for instance, to get your actual enhance web components running in these different frameworks. And you did a handful of them?
Yeah. So we started with WordPress because that kind of felt like one of the more neglected places these days. It's like everyone wants to use and run WordPress, but the actual running and using of WordPress is a bit gnarly. It's grown over time. So Ryan Bethel and our team got that working. And he actually had the epiphany that any language with a DOM parser would actually be suitable to do an implementation of our server render algorithm. So he did a pass that's pure PHP just to do the comparison, see what it's like. And it is faster to go drop into pure PHP. So he's been kind of pulling on that thread a little bit lately. The PHP, of course, has a great DOM parser and been doing HTML for a long time. So that was the first one. I did a Rails demo. We got a Flask one. I think there might be a there's a few people jumped and did .NET ones, which I was grateful for. And trying to think of what else. Oh, there's a Go one and a Rust one, of course. So yeah, we built out a few. We want to kind of go a little higher level though and do examples in like, instead of doing it in Ruby, do it in Rails. Instead of doing it in PHP, do it in WordPress and Laravel, you know, that kind of thing.
Right, pick some frameworks and like show the integration points.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's say I was a backend Go person. Not that any of them would listen to JS Party because they despise JavaScript, but if I was,
I thought,
okay, I might want to try this out for Go. Like, what would be my steps? What would I do first? Like, write a web component and then port it or start with enhance first? What do you do?
We've got a demo repo. I'd say join our Discord because there's probably someone else out there that's already done this and see what they've said. But I do believe we have a Go repo, though I don't know. Let me really quickly check. So our GitHub is enhanced-dev, and then you can just do a search for your favorite language. And we do have enhanced-ssr-go, and it's just a little silly. I guess the way that Go developers like to work is as few dependencies as possible. So our example is a whopping 120 lines of code that demonstrate doing this without any dependencies at all. So that's kind of cool.
That's not too bad. Considering
I've never deployed a Go thing myself. It's on the list of things I'm kind of interested in because it looks like a slightly nicer C, if anything, but I don't really know much about it.
Yeah, well, universal binaries sure are nice. You know, you compile it all and just like ship a single file to a server somewhere and just say run, you know, or .slash.
Yeah, and I know it gets killer good performance too, and Go and both Rust are very WASM centric projects.
Right.
Very little outside machinery to get that working.
So if you were a typical full stack JS dev and you already had your Express backend, or maybe you're running Bun or something, like you don't need to think about this. You would just go for enhance straight up, right? Because that's what already what enhance does. Is it's for, you wouldn't, I mean, there's no reason to put it inside of WASM because now you're just like wrapping a container around something you don't need.
Yeah, exactly. I think, I don't know the exact performance delta, but I think it's pretty significantly better to just run it in straight node. I know that we're rendering something silly though, like thousands of elements per second. So unless you've got like a really egregious DOM, it should be fine.
And can you take existing web components that maybe are just running in the browser via, you know, script tags or whatever and get those going? Is there anything like that's enhanced specific or like port? Is it a port?
There is. Yeah. So our trick for server rendering is a specific interface. And so you have to have a render method and it has to implement a specific signature. The signature is basically the method needs to be named render. It has to accept an object. That object has to have a key called HTML and a key called state. HTML is a tag template literal that we pass in, and state is state that gets passed in. And then you can do whatever you want in the body of your render function, but typically you would iterate over state and you would build up a variable to pass to HTML, which you return. And it sounds way more complicated than it is. You basically implement a function that returns HTML. And okay.
So there's a few things you have to conform to, but nothing that's too onerous.
Yeah. And so the kind of challenge with current web component systems like Lit is they implement the fullness of the DOM capabilities. And so when you're mounting a web component, it has a whole bunch of events, like one of them is called connected callback. And it's very common for people to generate HTML inside of all these events that run. So in order to server render, you basically have to mock the entire event system of the browser, which is why server rendering web components hasn't really been a thing, because mocking an entire browser's event system and then making most of it no ops is both challenging and kind of slow. So we cheat by saying, here's the place where you render HTML, and it can only be this place. And this isn't like some huge innovation. This is very similar to how React works, where it's like, you know, an immediate render pattern UI is a function of state, as it were. So same idea, same thing. And this lets us reuse the template on the server and the client so that we get a consistent experience and we don't have to mock out a whole browser on the back end to do our render step.
Are there certain things that just won't happen server side, or that like there's no reason to even do anything about
them? There's a bunch. Yeah. Like submit, click, drag, enter.
That's pretty typical. Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of stuff that just the browser just does that.
Right.
Most of what the browser does is respond to user interactions. And it tells us about this through events. And you don't need any of that server side. You know, I'm just rendering a header here. I'm just returning a bunch of inert HTML. So it's not a thing you need.
So what if you're rendering a header that has a form in it with a submit and stuff? Are you basically just rendering the first version of it and then the browser attaches to those events once it's there and then like you're done on the server side? It's all browser from there on out.
Yeah, exactly. And you can have a single definition for that. So you could have my form extends HTML element and then put all that business inside of that. And we'll do the initial render. And then if JavaScript kicks in, and I think that's a very key statement because JavaScript doesn't always work. And it's okay to say that. It typically fails like 1-2% of the time for different reasons. Network requests, you know, crappy carriers, drove under a bridge, whatever. Or you had an error on your page. And in client render scenarios, that's bad because nothing happens. You just get a blank screen. So if we server render and then if JavaScript kicks in, you know, script tags there, it'll take over at that point.
What about when things do go wrong? Do you have any visibility into stuff or is it just like a black box?
It's HTML. So, you know, it's pretty forgiving. So a lot of following the spec means not failing, but then trying our best, which might result in failure. So an example would be I opened my H1 tag, but I forgot to close it. What do we do? There's ways that the browser and Parse5 in particular will handle this, and it'll do its best effort, and it'll give you HTML back, and that HTML will render, but it might not look like how you want it to look. So you get that experience. There's no real black box, as it were, client side. In fact, I'd say it's substantially better than current transpiling techniques because this is all just native. So if you go to enhance.dev, the website, and view source, you'll see the source that we wrote, and it's a bunch of, you know, HTML elements, custom elements, and all the browser dev tools work. You don't need a special plugin or anything like that. There's no source maps.
Oh, that's cool.
It's just the raw HTML as it should be. And it looks very semantic and what you would like it to look like, you know, like your header says my header. And when you open it, it's got a header element inside of it. Form would be like my form.
Oh, that's cool. So the dev tools are very much aware of web components and able to handle them natively.
They're really good. Yeah. There's some weirdness with slots still. So if you have a component that slots in content in a few different places, sometimes they'll show that content in a different spot in the DOM in Chrome DevTools. That's a bit weird, but it's trying to preserve all of the information so you know it's slotted content. So that's one part where I've been like, oh, that's kind of strange, but you get used to it.
Okay. That's cool. I didn't know that. I haven't actually jumped on the bandwagon yet. I'm just kind of like over here writing my HTML still.
Yeah.
But interested. I see my good friend Zach Leatherman publishing web components for all kinds of things. And it's like, Okay, people are actually like writing these and releasing them as things you can use. And I find that pretty compelling. So I'm like ready to, I'm getting close to like jumping in the water, but just kind of watching other people for now. And I've heard of like this HTML web component movement where it's like a subset. Can you tell me what that means? It's all JavaScript, right?
Yeah, so we've been doing this the whole time. I think a lot of other people kind of stumbled into a similar pattern and started calling them HTML web components, which seems like a bit of an oxymoron. But the meaning is basically they're components that don't require client JavaScript to render per se. And so like there's nothing preventing you right now from doing my suite list component and just literally writing like my dash suite dash list dash component and like putting that in HTML with no client side JavaScript whatsoever. You're allowed to do that. That's okay. And HTML web components are this. They're components that don't necessarily have a JavaScript analog that's or on client that's running. And but they often can and do, but like you're supplying the HTML initially. The other aspect is treating the shadow DOM as an opt-in as opposed to a default. So when web components first kind of came around, one of the very, I think, strong desires was to have better encapsulation. I don't want to open up some component and have it leaking its styles and stuff all over the rest of my DOM, especially if I'm bringing it in from a third party. And that's a wonderful idea, and that's a great capability. This comes with a bunch of trade-offs. If you have a shadow root, or if you're using the shadow DOM inside of your web component, a ton of behavior changes in the document. One of the big changes of the behavior can be the form elements might not behave the way that you think they will. And you'll have to write a ton of JavaScript to fix that. And people struggled with this, and they've written a ton, like classically, we write a ton of JavaScript to fix the problems that we introduced with JavaScript. And we looked at the problem and we were like, well, just don't use a shadow DOM, you know, like just make that an opt-in. And so like, if you need it, it's there. We're not saying never use it, but we are saying like, hey, maybe my header component isn't going to be shared on another person's website, right? It seems pretty reasonable that my header would belong to me. Most of my components, in fact, almost all of them will probably only be used by me. So do I need to like protect myself from me? I mean, somewhat, but like we can.
Is that a philosophical question, Brian?
Or yeah. But like we can definitely get away with not using the shadow DOM as a default and then make that an opt-in for richer components that maybe get shared across different environments. And so an HTML web component is a component that comes with its HTML already rendered and maybe doesn't use client JavaScript and probably doesn't use the shadow DOM. That's the definition for me.
Okay. And the advantage being that it is faster and more portable.
Faster, portable, more predictable. You're working with the shadow DOM is very much like working in an uncanny valley. It's like the DOM you're used to, except there's a whole bunch of exceptions. So styling is going to work different. Forms are going to be broken. It's going to take a sec to initialize. So there can be some jank in the rendering. And so this just walks right around all those problems. And again, just so everyone is clear, I'm not saying shadow DOM bad, not saying shadow DOM don't use. I'm saying shadow DOM is a good opt-in and maybe not the best default. The light DOM got us here. most websites are built with the light DOM. So it's okay to build with the light DOM and then treat shadow DOM as like a last knife in the boot kind of thing.
That makes sense to me.
It's a bit controversial because the whole web component thing kind of waved the shadow DOM flag a lot. And
it did.
Really tried to push that. And a ton of devs are realizing like, hey, maybe I don't need that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's not a good part, perhaps.
Seemed like some of that, and I'm going back a long time now, I'm not sure how long all of this has been out, but it seemed like the shadow DOM and some of the encapsulation stuff was one of the reasons why web components were kind of eschewed at first, or that people were saying like, this is not going to be ready for prime time, or I wouldn't use this, and they're too complicated. I can't remember, but there was like a lot of pushback against the early versions of web components.
There was, and it's for a variety of reasons, I think. You know, it's hard to get a group of devs to agree on anything anyways.
Right.
And the ergonomics are a bit funky. At the time of their definition, classy based stuff was very popular. React was, you know, extending an element. And so they wanted to have those similar ergonomics. But by the time it shipped, it became a lot more functional in the kind of mainstream programming world. And so, you know, it looks a little long in the tooth. You got an extend an HTML element, which feels like, you know, kind of classy, maybe not quite right.
Right.
The shadow DOM stuff is a cold shower as soon as you get forms involved, because you got to use an API called element internals. One of our devs did an example where he re-implements a checkbox. And, you know, like just a boring old Boolean checkbox. It's about 250 lines of code to make a checkbox work inside of the shadow DOM.
Wow.
If you don't use the shadow root, the checkbox just works. So now that's a checkbox. Most forms have a lot more going on. And, you know, you end up with a ton of bloat just to make a form do what it already could do.
Right.
The argument would be, well, what if I want, you know, the encapsulation of the shadow DOM? Well, most forms are pretty specific to my application use case. Like, not many people are sharing my database schema. So I think it's generally okay to keep a form out of the shadow DOM until further notice. And then certain elements absolutely may be needed. A good example is a text area that's a rich text editor. But you would probably want to serve the form with a text area and then let JavaScript take over and do all of its business. But make sure you get a working version first with that text area. So it's just an approach. And I think actually that's another way to look at HTML web components there. They're treating web components as a progressive enhancement step, as opposed to treating them like something that you reify from running JavaScript and executing it. And so it becomes, JavaScript's still there. It's still running. It's still cool. We love JavaScript, but it happens after the script tag loads. And so you want to give people a working user experience first.
Yeah. Especially if your JavaScript fails, it's not even first. It's altogether, there's still a working experience that falls back. I guess falls back isn't the way that progressive enhancement people like to look at it, the other way around, right?
Well, yeah. I mean,
it's the same thing, yeah, different perspective. Thing. Yeah.
Yeah. What the term graceful degradation.
There you go. Gracefully degrades.
Yes.
What's up, friends? I'm here in the breaks with Sama Alam Naylor from Sentry, Senior Developer Advocate. Let's talk about the levels of error monitoring. So let's talk about error monitoring with medium to large-ish teams. And I don't even know how to quantify that necessarily to say maybe it's a team of 5 or 8. Maybe that's a medium team. Maybe medium to largest is like 20 plus, 50 plus engineers. You got multiple teams. You got multiple services. You got multiple disciplines within the engineer organization. How does Sentry go from indie dev, solo application developer, or a small team to scaling to support larger to mid-sized teams? What changes?
So it's interesting that you mentioned microservices. And often these days, when you have larger teams or you have multiple teams in an organization working on a product, you will have your application split out into little projects, different repos, microservices. And sometimes it can be difficult to know where an error is coming from, for example, if you just send all your errors to one place. And sometimes it might be difficult to know where the error started and where the error finished up. But what's really good with Sentry is that we have this concept called tracing. With Sentry tracing, you essentially connect your back and front ends together. If you want to know the details about it, it's through an HTTP header. And that's how Sentry will trace your requests from one service to the next, from the back end to the front end. And so in the Sentry app itself, you can physically trace what happened from where the request originated on the front end, then all the different services that the request passes through to, and then back to the front end, and then be able to identify exactly where the problem happened and exactly what in the front end triggered it or what in the back end triggered it. You can view the source codes and the stack traces all related to it. And then what you can do is, based on where the error came from, you can then automatically assign those issues to particular members of particular teams using things like maybe custom tags or other kind of identifiers on the issue itself. And so it helps you triage, like Sentry gives you that separation, yet also brings it all together to help you understand the bigger picture, the smaller things about what went wrong in like a fine-grained way, and then allows you to configure the app itself to perform particular actions depending on what happened. You know, like a lot of the time, large teams can actually get inundated with a lot of noise. I remember working for a company where we had two teams, a back end and a front end team, but everyone was getting every single error from everywhere. And so what happens eventually is you ignore all of the errors. Oh, it's failing as expected. It's just noise. It's getting in the way of my day-to-day coding. But if you are more selective about the types of alerts that you send and that you receive as someone who's doing a particular job, you'll be less likely to ignore them, more likely to address the root cause, and then eventually you will have no alerts and no bugs and your application will be perfect.
Okay, get Sentry, go fix it. Too easy. Check them out at sentry.io. That's sentry.io. And make sure you use our code changelog and you'll get $100 off the team plan, which is super awesome. Again, use the code changelog, get $100 off the team plan, sentry.io.
How much of this is platformizable insofar as like, will it work its way into the platform? I'm thinking of the hacky stuff that y'all are doing to make this possible. Like, are there ways that the browsers and the platform creators can do things to help us? Or,
I mean, yeah, big time. So there's a couple of different groups. There's the Web Components Work Community group, and then there's the Open UI group. And I think we've all realized that we've implemented tabs enough times now, like we're right, feeling pretty good on that one.
We could use some more high level widgets, right?
We could use a few more, and like stuff that we're like, you know, combo boxes with icons or the accordion thing. Like, come on, how many times do we got to do this? So some higher level components is a big one. I think another big one is figuring out DOM diffing for folks. So we still find it's probably better to surgically update the DOM inside of a component. Bringing these various ways of morphing a DOM between two diffs, VDOM approaches, are pretty heavy and they're pretty slow. And this just feels like a candidate for standardization. Give me an inner HTML that's smart. And I know that the browser vendors have been punting this one around since React happened. So it's probably a pretty long road, but it really does feel like something that we need as a native primitive, because everybody brings a different solution to diffing and they all have funky trade-offs.
Yeah. Not to mention you got to ship that logic every time, right?
Yeah, it's slower. It's a payload. It's new rules too. Like, we find the safest way to do a diff is to have a bunch of IDs. So your DOM bloats out with like a whole bunch of instance IDs. You know which elements are supposed to be where. So having a native way to do that would be pretty great. I think otherwise, though, like, we're always looking so far forward, and yet things have gotten really good. Like, the browser's pretty incredible these days, like, and CSS especially. Like, I'm moving more logic into CSS these days than I am into JavaScript, and I don't see that slowing down. We're just getting more and more toys for declaratively doing stuff, and it's kind of wonderful how little JavaScript we actually do need on the client these days.
Yeah, it feels like the golden years for CSS right now. Like, so for so long it felt like it wasn't going anywhere, and now, as a person who is not daily into it, I'm sometimes overwhelmed by how much new stuff there is. I'm like, wow, I didn't even realize you could do that. You know, and it goes deep too. Like,
yeah, I saw there's a light dark function coming now.
Oh, really?
So like, that's going to be built in. You'll just be able to like define a variable. This is what to run when light. This is what to run to dark. Like, nice. Super nice. Like, lots of little things in there. Like nesting. We got custom properties now.
Yep.
Like, hiding and showing business is becoming a declarative thing, so we can just do that without having to resort to like hiding and showing divs with JavaScript. Like, pretty great.
Yeah. Can we get to a point, I don't know enough about design systems to answer this, maybe you do, maybe you don't, but can we get to a point where you can just formalize your design system into the browser somehow? And just like, you know, a lot like CSS variables, but it's like, here's my rules for my design system, and I'm kind of done, you know, or I'm at least kind of there.
I mean, Brad Frost has been banging a drum about global design systems in his blog lately, and I'm pretty bullish on this idea too. So I'm not sure how we get there completely. I think we need some new components. I think we need some new toys from a high level, but like we probably don't need to re-implement button every time anymore. And custom properties points to a way to make things somewhat themable. The irony to me of this is that we will end up with a flat file of variables. And that really like starts to look like BAM again to me, where we've got like, you know, primary, secondary, and tertiary colors and like,
right.
But I don't know, but it feels like we're super close to figuring this one out. And like, there's all the toys are laying around, but it's an unassembled Lego castle right now. And like, we know that there's something
there. Right. We need someone to create the schema or the plan, you know, like to put them all together and say, here, use this recipe. And then we all start to use it. And then we have the golden years again, the glory days begin.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that's just not reusable. And there's also a bunch of stuff that is just not interactive. And so like, sure. these are two things that I think we got to get better at realizing. Like, most of the elements in the page are inert, and probably the majority of your visual brand is not reusable to other brands. Like, Walmart's not going to get much use out of IKEA's design system. Mm-hmm. And that's probably okay. But there is a bunch of stuff just under the surface that we all have.
Sure.
Typography and accordions and buttons. And so like, can we normalize that at least?
Right. Let's raise the tide, but we don't want another Twitter bootstrap where like every website looks the same. Like, we still want you to be able to, we don't want the web to get boring because of this. And that's what tends to happen when you create forms and you create standards and everything must conform. Then all of a sudden every website just has different colors, but the same exact buttons. And we don't want to put people in that box by any means.
No, it would be cool to get back to those flashy days where things were a little more experimental.
Do you literally mean the flash days, you know, where you load like this flash animation?
Maybe not the loading thing.
Like 30 seconds to load this little, they're always cool.
Well, I mean, we're kind of there right now with the skeleton screens and stuff, but it would be cool to see a little more. Yeah, I mean, like, CSS is incredible. We can do so much with that now. We should be getting a bit more creative out there.
I agree. So Enhance is the framework. Enhance WASM is how you run it on somewhat arbitrary backends. What is Begin? So Begin is your business. Can you tell us how this fits into your whole story? Like, how does Enhance fit into Begin? And what do you all do? Are you an agency? Are you a startup, et cetera?
Yeah, we're a startup. We do hosting. We help you deploy to AWS in particular.
Okay.
We think lots of people do that. And we've felt over the years that there could be a higher level, nicer way to do that. And Begin is that. It's about a minute and a half and you can deploy a site on Amazon, which is significantly faster than any other way to do it. We have a local development environment for doing that. And so you can start building right away without a credit card on your own machine. You don't need to sign up for Amazon necessarily. You can use our free tier. But if things, you know, grow and you outgrow us, which is pretty normal, we can also deploy to your Amazon account. And so Begin really started with us trying to build a way to build serverless applications. So when serverless really started to kick off, a lot of different approaches emerged, and a lot of them were pretty complicated. And we wanted to just cut all the business out that was complicated, get rid of all the infrastructure concerns, and just focus on your code. And that's been going well, and lots of people are using it. And it's based on an open source project called Architect that's a part of the OpenJS Foundation. So you can look that up at arc.codes. You can run all of it yourself. You don't need to use us. You can deploy Architect apps to your own CloudFormation or your own AWS at any time. And so that's nice because, you know, Begin is a startup. And so if we have an exit and we go away, your code is still portable to your own Amazon account, which we think is a customer-friendly way to work. So Begin's good, and that's great, and that's all very back-end centric. When serverless happened, I really believed that this would just be the way people would want to work. They wouldn't want to load balance a monolith or set up, you know, Kubernetes and pods and all this other business. They just want to write their code and run it. What I missed was that a lot of people that are coming to the cloud are coming from front end, and that's where all the growth is. And so this is where Enhance fits in. We didn't want to be another React framework way to get to the cloud. There's a bunch of those. And they're kind of, they do their thing, and that's fine. We wanted to be a way to do it with truly modern primitives and web components. And yeah, you don't need to use us or Amazon with Enhance, but it's designed to work well with those places and deploys to those places.
Very cool. Makes sense. Well, begin.com, enhance.dev, and enhance.dev/WASM. We will link up all the things. I've called it now both pronunciations throughout the show, just to keep our listener on their toes. We don't want to bore anybody with standardization. Anything else, Brian? This looks really cool. I'm excited about it. I hope that people kick the tires, try it for themselves, you know, implement their own backends and start to build out some tooling around it. So it's not just an idea and an example, but it's actually maybe something that's vibrant and community oriented.
Yeah, I would love it if you're out there and you're writing, you know, anything really, but like especially not Node.js, we need your help. So please join our Discord. And if you want to give us a hand, we're looking for people that are cool with Python, PHP, Java, .NET, Rust, Go, Zig, I guess, if you wanted to do that on the back end. So we want to build out all those examples. We've just started implementing a suite of components ourselves so that we can say, well, the kind of dream would be we've got a page like, let's say, components.rb, enhance.dev/components.rb, but then you could change it to .php and you'd get the same page. And that would be one code base. So that's what we're working towards. We are definitely still in the early prototype phases. Also would like to ask out there if folks could take a look at checking out Xtism, because I think it's got a lot of promise and it's just really cool. Those guys are crushing it. If you have any JavaScript that you want to try and run in different places, do check that out. And yeah, let us know how it goes. You know, and again, we're not a zero-sum thinking company. We're super into open source. So like, you know, if you're a Svelte hacker, it would be cool to see if Svelte could run inside of Java. You know, if you're a React hacker, I would love to see it running inside of Python directly. Like, let's do that. And then let's benchmark these things and see how well they perform.
Yeah. So many interesting possibilities with WebAssembly that just weren't obvious. You know, and the promise of WebAssembly, I've always said it's been, you know, next year it's going to blow up for a very long time. And you've seen cool things that have happened, you know, people who have leveraged it for much success, but not like a mass, you know, they're never mainstream dev. You know, it's always been like, these people are using it for this and you can kind of do it. But now it's kind of like, hey, there's so many things that it can do that just, it's just interesting.
It's one of the weird, web components went through the same thing where it had this initial hype and then a pretty deep trough of disillusionment. Mm-hmm. And now this plateau of productivity is happening where people are just building cool stuff. And, Yeah, I don't know what's up with that. That's a thing though lately with like our industry is. Where it's like something's really promising. We all get super excited about it, but then we're all like, eh, there's some other exciting thing.
And then right.
Like, wait, no, this thing's still cool.
5 years later, we come back. Oh, it's still laying on the floor. I'll pick it up. Oh, it's a little bit nicer than it was before, but not, you know, not majorly different. Still the same idea, just maybe a little bit nicer. And we start using it. So I don't know.
I mean, I guess with Wasm, they had to do a lot of infra work in all these other runtimes, but now it's kind of baked in everywhere. So
every language and runtime has a good reason to have good support at this point.
Weirdly though, the Java community, not as much.
Really?
Yeah. We started with Wasm time and there was some strange like attitudes there where like, I remember reading, I read like a Stack Overflow post where someone's like, the JVM is the universal runtime.
Okay,
sure. We've been hearing that one for a while too, but like, right. I just want to run a bit of Wasm there. Like, but that's part of the reason we actually found XDISM, because they had support for Java, whereas Wasm time didn't. So I don't know.
Yeah, you kind of have a little bit of the innovator's dilemma there. You know, the incumbent can't see it because they can't see it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that might have been, well, and okay, that was the original promise of the JVM.
For sure. But not a silver bullet. Neither will WebAssembly also will not be a silver bullet. But, you know,
no.
we put together these technologies in ways that serve people, and we hopefully get better at it over time. And eventually we forget about a thing and then we pick it up later and we realize this is useful. So it's cool that you guys picked it up and realized it and actually are using it, hopefully, to much success. So I'm rooting for you. I'm excited to give you as much coverage as you can, because I think that there's a lot here that could help a lot of people if they see it. So.
Well, thanks, Ben. Appreciate that.
Awesome. For Brian LaRue, check out all the links in the show notes. I'm Jared. This is JS Party, and we'll talk to you all on the next one. We would love to get more awesome reviews for the pod into Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So for a limited time only, you leave us a thoughtful 5-star review, send the evidence to jsparty@changelog.com, and we'll send you a free pack of Changelog stickers right to your door. Let's do this. Thanks once again to our partners at fly.io, to our Beat Freak in Residence, Breakmaster Cylinder, and to our friends at Sentry. We love Sentry and have been using it for years. If and when it's time for you to check it out, use code CHANGELOG. That helps us because Sentry knows we're making an impact on their business, and it helps you because they'll give you $100 off the team plan. Once again, use code CHANGELOG, all one word. Next up on the pod, Corey LaVisca joins Amel and Jess to talk about Shoelace, a forward-thinking library of web components. That's all for now, but come on back and party with us again next week.